Welcome to 30 Minutes of VOA Learning English, the voice of America's information service for people learning English. Join us now for our daily magazine show, As It Is, and other programs designed for English learners.
Hello again from Washington. I'm Jim Tedder. Jill Robbins joins us today to teach us English and then inform us about some special satellites that are designed to help developing countries. We have a lot of work to do, so let's hear first about some unusual but important words that we all need to know. Jill?
One fish, two fish, red fish, blue fish, goes the Dr. Seuss children's story. Why isn't it two fishes? You may think,
okay, it's hard to count fish, so we group them all together. No problem.
It's easy to understand that farmers would not worry about making plurals when they talk about sheep. After all, they are almost always in a group. When you have one sheep, you can also call it a ram or a ewe, and make those nouns plural by adding an S, rams and ewes. Let's look at some other things we can make plural. You've got a left foot and a right foot. Put them together, and what have you got? 2 feet. That doesn't follow the add an S rule either. Same with mouse, and it's plural, mice. What happened to our neat rule for making words plural? The answer is in our history. English came from German roots. German grammar changes the vowel sound in the middle of the word to show it is plural. The plural form of the German word for goose, Gans, is Gänse. The vowel with 2 dots over it is called an umlaut. So goose becomes geese in English. There are other plurals where the vowel changes, like in the German pattern. Man, men, and woman, women are examples of different vowel sounds in plural words. Sometimes a consonant changes, as with words that end in an F sound, such as leaf. The voiceless sound f takes on a voiced quality, or v, and an s sound is added to the word. We have autumn leaves and sharp knives. Another way to make plurals in English is to add the suffix en, or n. We see this in the words brother, brethren, child, children, and ox, oxen. These are words that come from Old English. With words that come from foreign languages, there are some patterns that may help you remember the plural. Many technical words in English came from Latin. Let's look at the plural of some words from Latin. Words that end in US drop that ending and add I to become plural, as in fungus, fungi, and cactus, cacti. Listen to this conversation. What is that orange thing in the tree?
It's a fungus. There are a lot of different fungi in the forest.
For words that end in UM, the ending changes to A, as in the words datum, data, and medium, media. These two words are more common in their plural forms than the singular forms in our digital life. Listen to how the words medium and media appear in this conversation. I heard you got a job at the New York Times.
Yeah, I'm glad to be working in mass media.
But newspapers are a dying medium, aren't they?
Hey, I hope not. I'm writing a blog for them.
When a word from Latin ends in EX or IX, the plural ending is ICES. This results in index, indices, and matrix, matrices. Here's another conversation. The financial news is bad. The Dow Jones index is down.
Don't worry. There are other indices, like employment, going up.
Are you ready to try making plurals with some English words? Use the Germanic pattern for these words.
Tooth.
Is your answer teeth?
Wolf.
Is your answer wolves? Use the Latin pattern for these words.
Memorandum.
Your answer should be memoranda.
Focus.
Your answer should be foci. There are many more irregular plural forms in English. We'll look at those in another episode of Everyday Grammar.
You are listening to the Voice of America, and we are coming to you from Washington. Satellite technology is the newest tool for helping developing countries deal with climate change and natural disasters. Satellites can measure conditions on the ground and share the data with communities. A partnership between the National Aeronautics and Space Administration and the U.S. Agency for International Development has invented such a system called SERVIR. Once again, here's Jill.
SERVIR captures images and environmental data, like dangerous weather and changes in water resource use. Scientists feed that information into complex computer programs. The results of the analysis are shared with people living in the affected areas, as well as governments and organizations, to help them react and prepare. Dan Irwin is the director of the NASA SERVIR Coordination Office. He told VOA Learning English that the SERVIR project shares important information with countries all over the world.
So the main goal of SERVIR really is taking space-based information and making it available to people around the world so they can really address issues that they have in their countries, whether it be deforestation, air quality, and bringing it down to village and making it available to people for better decision-making. We need to be able to convert that data to address the cares and concerns that countries have around the world. And as NASA, we can work with countries, but it's then how do we take it even further? How do we go from space to country, down to state or provincial level, down to the village level?
Jennifer Frankel Reed is the Senior Climate Change Specialist for USAID. She explained how SERVIR has helped warn Bangladeshis of flooding and prevented people in El Salvador from eating unsafe seafood. In Kenya, which depends heavily on tea farming, farmers have avoided losing crops to rising temperatures.
The idea is that through our local partnerships with hubs, we can bring that data, analyze it in ways that people can use, translate it into easy-to-use formats, and then help people with the decisions that those data inform.
Developed in 2004, SERVIR brought together the U.S. agencies with the World Bank and Central American Commission on Environment and Development. The first hub was established in Panama in 2005, but was closed in 2011. Other hubs were established in Kenya, Nepal, and Thailand between 2008 and 2014. Both Mr. Irwin and Ms. Frankel Reed said the project's goal was to empower people with information to help them grow.
We hope to continue to expand, but ultimately and absolutely the most important thing about SERVIR is enabling amazing people around the world.
The project now operates in more than 30 countries. I'm Jill Robbins.
This is VOA, the Voice of America.
Coming up, more programs designed for English learners. You can read and listen to our reports and download MP3s at learningenglish.voanews.com. You can learn with us on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at VOA Learning English.
From VOA Learning English, this is the Economics Report. China's decision to end its one-child policy is likely to affect the country's economy. Official Chinese media reported last month that all couples will be permitted to have two children. The change in policy is expected to create new investments and increase demand for goods and services. The move comes as China's economy is slowing. However, the change also may increase demand for higher pay and increase labor costs. Speaking at a press conference Tuesday, Chinese officials predicted that the new policy would raise economic growth by about 0.5%. They said it would provide China with about 30 million laborers by 2050. He Weiwen is with the Chongyang Institute for Financial Studies at Renmin University in Beijing. He says that more children will mean more maternity homes, hospitals, kindergartens, and schools. It will certainly result in massive investment in these areas. The two-child policy will also lead to more spending on the second child and thus contribute to economic growth. He added, the families having the second child will reduce their savings to meet the new requirement. The policy limiting families to one child began more than 30 years ago. When the new policy goes into effect, 91 million couples will have official permission for a second child. The government expects that at least 60% of parents having two children will come from rural areas. Limited health care and educational centers in rural areas and small cities have long been a problem in China. The government will have to make new investments in these areas to provide quality centers for families with two children. The Conference Board, a U.S.-based research group, says there are both good and bad effects that might result from the two-child policy. The group says an increase in the number of children could have a positive impact on the consumption of products and services catering towards child-rearing. It adds, this could lead to growth and employment demand in those industries. But the Conference Board also warned of the effects of rising labor costs and greater pressure on aging grandparents. These men and women are often forced to take care of the young children of working mothers and fathers. The main purpose of permitting two children in each family is to deal with the aging of China's population and shrinking workforce. And that's the Economics Report. I'm Mario Ritter.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. In July of 1861, Union soldiers from the North and Confederate soldiers from the South fought the first major battle in the American Civil War. They clashed at Manassas, or Bull Run, Virginia, less than 50 kilometers from Washington. The Union soldiers fought fiercely, but two large Confederate forces broke the Union attack. This week in our series, Harry Monroe and Kay Gallant tell about some of the other early battles of the Civil War.
Northerners had expected to win the Battle of Bull Run. They believed the Confederacy would fall if the Union won a big military victory early in the war. Now, however, there was great fear that Southern soldiers would seize Washington. The Union needed to build and train an army quickly. President Abraham Lincoln named General George McClellan to do this. McClellan was 34 years old. The young general had two important tasks. He must defend Washington from attack, and he must build an army to strike at enemy forces in Virginia. McClellan wasted no time. He put thousands of troops into position around the city, and he built 48 forts. After this rush of activity, however, little more happened for a long time. McClellan told his wife, "I shall take my own time to make an army that will be sure of success. As soon as I feel my army is well organized and well trained and strong enough, I will force the rebels to a battle." McClellan kept making excuses for why he would not move against the enemy. His excuses became a continuing source of trouble for President Lincoln. The public, the press, and politicians all demanded that McClellan do something. They wanted to win the war, and win it right away.
McClellan commanded the biggest army in the Union, the Army of the Potomac. But it was not the only army. Others were battling Confederate forces in the West. The Confederates had moved up through Tennessee into the border state of Kentucky. They built forts and other defensive positions across the southern part of the state. They also blocked as many railroads and rivers as they could. Their job was to keep Union forces from invading the South through Kentucky. One of the Union generals in the area was Ulysses Grant. Grant had served in the Army for 20 years. He had fought in America's war against Mexico and had won honors for his bravery. When that war ended, he was sent to an army base far from his wife and children. He did not like being without them, and he did not like being an officer in peacetime. Grant began to drink too much alcohol. He began to be a problem. In 1854, he was asked to leave the army. When the Civil War started, Grant organized a group of unpaid soldiers in Illinois. With the help of a member of Congress, he was named a general. All of the other Union generals knew Ulysses Grant. Few had any faith in his abilities. They were sure he would always fail.
Grant, however, had faith in himself and his men. He believed he could force Confederate soldiers to withdraw from both Kentucky and Tennessee. Then he would be free to march directly into the Deep South, Mississippi. Two Confederate forts stood in Grant's way. They were in Tennessee, close to the Kentucky border. United States Navy gunboats captured the first, Fort Henry, on the Tennessee River. That fort was easy to attack and not well defended. The fighting was over by the time Grant and his men got there. The second, Fort Donelson, was nearby on the Cumberland River. It was stronger and defended by 20,000 soldiers. Grant surrounded the fort and let the Navy gunboats shell it. The fighting there lasted several days.
At one point, the Confederates tried to break out of the fort and escape. They opened a hole in the Union line and began to retreat. Suddenly, however, their commanding officer decided it would be wrong to retreat. He ordered them back to the fort. After that, there was no choice. The Confederates would have to surrender. The commanding officer sent a message to General Grant. What were the terms of surrender? Grant's answer was simple. No terms, except unconditional and immediate surrender. The Confederates gave up Fort Donelson. Grant took 14,000 prisoners. It was the greatest Union victory since the start of the war. Ulysses Grant was a hero. Newspapers called him Unconditional Surrender Grant.
After the Union victory at Fort Donelson, Confederate forces withdrew from Tennessee. They moved farther south and began to regroup at Corinth, Mississippi. Confederate generals hoped to build one big army to stop Ulysses Grant. They would have to move fast. Grant was marching toward Corinth with 40,000 men. Another 35,000, under the command of Don Buell, were to meet him on the way. Grant arrived in the area first. He waited for Buell, 30 kilometers from Corinth, near a small country meeting hall called Shiloh Church. Confederate General Albert Sidney Johnston was waiting, too. He had more than 40,000 men, about the same as Grant, and he was expecting another 20,000. But when he learned that Grant was nearby, he decided not to wait. He would attack immediately.
Johnston did not know it, but his attack came as a surprise to the Union Army. Union officers had refused to believe reports that Johnston was on the move. They said his army was not strong enough to attack. Union troops did not prepare defensive positions. They had no protection when the battle began. The fighting at Shiloh was the bitterest of the war. It was not one battle, but many. Groups of men fought each other all across the wide battlefield. From a distance, they shot at each other. Close up, they cut each other with knives. The earth became red with blood. The dead and wounded soon lay everywhere. At first, the Confederates pushed Grant's army back. They had only to break through one more line, and victory would be theirs. But in the thick of the struggle, General Johnston was shot in the leg. The bullet cut through an artery Johnston bled to death before help arrived. Any hope for a Southern victory at Shiloh died with him. By the time the fighting began again the next day, General Buell had arrived to help Grant. The Confederate Army retreated. The Union Army let it go.
Shiloh. The word itself came to mean death and destruction. The Battle of Shiloh had brought home to the American people, both of the North and South, the horror of war. It was the first time so many men, 100,000, had fought against each other in the Western world. It was the American people's first real taste of the bloodiness of modern warfare. As one soldier who fought there said, it was too shocking, too horrible. I hope to God that I may never see such things again. The North won the Battle of Shiloh, but it paid a very high price for victory. More than 13,000 Union soldiers were killed, wounded, or missing. On the Confederate side, more than 10,000 soldiers were killed or wounded. The North celebrated the news of its victory, but joy quickly turned to anger when the public learned of the heavy losses. People blamed General Grant. They demanded that President Lincoln dismiss him. Lincoln thought of the two men who were now his top military commanders, McClellan and Grant. They were so different. McClellan organized an army and then did nothing. Grant organized an army and moved. Lincoln said of Grant, I cannot do without this man. He fights. We will continue our story of the Civil War next week.
Our program was written by Frank Beardsley. The narrators were Harry Monroe and Kay Gallant. Our series can be found online with transcripts, podcasts, and historical images at voaspecialenglish.com. You can also follow our programs at twitter.com/voalearnenglish. Join us again next week for The Making of a Nation, an American history series in VOA Special English.